The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Kate Andrews and Katie Balls. Today the Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced more details on the future of the furlough plan and was much more generous than many had expected. Kate, what were the main points?
So rather than implementing a short, sharp shock to rolling back the furloughing scheme, he's going to do it gradually over the next 5 months. So in June and July, all remains the same. Furloughed employees will get up to 80% of their salaries, capped at £2,500 a month. Come August, employers are going to be asked to pay national insurance and pension contributions, which totals roughly 5% of employment costs. September, they're going to be asked to pay an increase of 10% of their employees' salaries, and then that rises to 20% in October, and the scheme ends at the end of the month. So that is going to be a big change, of course, at the end of October, when you go from contributing 20% presumably back to your employee's full-time salary. But in the meanwhile, it really is a gradual build. And I think it's as generous as the Chancellor could have been while also acknowledging that the furloughing scheme cannot continue indefinitely. It's been very generous to the self-employed. They're going to get a second round of being able to apply for grants in August. It is keeping people in employment for as long as is fiscally possible to do.
Katie, the Chancellor refused to say how much this would cost in total, but Paul Johnson from the IFS, as Kate mentions in her blog, estimates that it could exceed £100 billion. What's your reaction to a slow easing out of this furlough scheme?
Yeah, I think Kate's right. Rishi Sunak's decision today to go for this gradual easing, to almost tiptoe out of the furlough scheme, as Kate puts it on her blog on Coffee House, I think is the most delicate way of doing it, but ultimately you can't escape the facts here, which is ultimately no matter how you do this, you are going to increase unemployment, at least in the short term. And I think that I thought one of the interesting questions in the Q&A at the press conference today came from Ed Conway at Sky, who asked, if there is a second peak in terms of coronavirus infections, could you see the furlough scheme potentially being brought back? At the moment, it ends, by the end of October. Something the Chancellor wouldn't be drawn on. But I do think if you look at the eye-watering sums that this scheme has cost in total, I do think in the government there's a sense that it is such, a huge cost. It would be hard to bring back, even if things get bad again. Perhaps you would find a way, but it's not something I think people would want to return to by any measure. So I think if you speak to people in the Treasury, they do regard this scheme as a big success. Lots of people said, actually, you've had so many people use it, sure, you didn't mean to spend this much money. I think the general view in government is, yes, they do think some people have misused the scheme, but ultimately they think it has kept a lot of people in employment at a time when actually it's been very important for them to have some form of income. And perhaps more importantly, there's a hope that it has prevented some unemployment in the sense by the time this is unrolled, some of these jobs will be kept. But none of this can escape the fact that when this is eventually rolled out, and even actually in the coming months when the different contributions that businesses are supposed to put in come to pass, we are going to have more and more people made unemployed. And I think the question is, how does the Chancellor manage that? He said in the press conference today that he was putting all his efforts into trying to make sure that those who are unemployed do have new jobs they can go to in the near future. But so much of this depends on social distancing, how coronavirus is changing the workplace, how quickly can you recover from this. That it's really hard to really know what the snapback is going to be like.
Kate, of course, the furlough scheme ends in October, which is just around the same time that a second wave probably would come because the weather's getting colder, and that's what experts seem to be thinking. Is it a good idea to say no furlough scheme for second wave if it does come?
I think it makes sense in the short term. Let's say a second wave did come, let's say it were worse. We don't really know what the government would do, what policies it would bring back in. But it's important to explain that this was a one-off big spend, because there's already some pushback on the rollback of the furlough scheme, already some suggestion that government should spend in an indefinite period of time paying for people's salaries. And as Rishi Sunak was so intent to push in the press conference today, this is unprecedented. This is a huge overreach for government that you wouldn't expect to see at any other time. So I think politically speaking, it's very important to brace businesses and employees for the fact that this is not something that government can just step in and do. I think he's also quite subtly trying to brace people for the fact that there will be more job losses. As Katie noted, the fact that the government can't save every job. He's been clear about that from the beginning, but of course has also been pushing a scheme that's designed to save jobs. So I think the public had a dose of economic reality today, still quite a light one, because we have the scheme for 5 more months. But slowly but surely, I think the Chancellor is trying to make business and employees realize it's not here forever.
Katie, something else that came up on the press conference today was the question of the threat level. The fact that the threat level hasn't actually gone underneath 4, which is what the government had previously said would be one of the criterion for relaxing restrictions. The question then was, why are we relaxing restrictions when the threat level hasn't gone down enough? What do you think is the answer to that?
So we heard today, I think, yes, in the press conference it was raised, but also there have been separate reports. So, for example, one Sage advisor has suggested that coronavirus is spreading too fast for lockdown to be lifted. Now, lockdown isn't being lifted completely, but clearly it's being eased to a degree. And is now, I think one journalist put it in the sense of suggesting that perhaps the Prime Minister was ignoring the science and just doing these things because he wanted to get on with, you know, opening up the economy and things. I think that what's quite interesting though is if you look at the measures that have actually been announced, which is the most imminent, so from Monday, the most striking is the fact that you can now meet with people outside of your household outside. Now, given that you can already do that in Northern Ireland and also Scotland have got plans to do that, it doesn't feel as though England is going much faster. If anything, actually, in the way it's worked out, there are some parts of the UK already doing that. So I think it depends how substantial. I think if you look at schools, I think that's clearly more controversial because it's difficult in terms of the teaching unions. And I think that if there is any evidence to suggest that our number is being ignored, people will be quick to pounce on that. But I do think part of the reason the government is pressing on with its lockdown easing is not just the economic reality in some cases, but also the fact that if you look at lots of European countries that are slightly ahead of the UK and so have eased their lockdown ahead of us. At the moment, there is a sense they're not getting that second peak. The R number may be going up to a degree, but they're not seeing that rise in cases. Now, I'm sure we could go to specific countries, there'd be some that might suggest otherwise, but I think the general sense in government is that if you look around parts of Europe where things have been relaxed, it is going fairly well. So that is encouraging the UK to think that they can do the same.
Kate, how much of a role do you think the economic concerns are playing in this decision to ease lockdown before, it seems like, before at least some scientists are comfortable with? And when you look at what's being eased is stuff like outdoor shops and that sort of thing.
I think it's a myriad of concerns. Obviously, economic downturn results in huge damage, not just in terms of the economy, but in terms to livelihoods and even people's health. There are plenty of studies to show that job loss and unemployment can lead to more chronic health conditions. So I think it's a lot of factors being taken into account. But this was inevitable for a government that was so adamant that all of its policy was focused on the science, as if that is black and white. The science has never been black and white. You have dissenting opinions, you have different models, different scenarios, and ultimately, the government's decision to be quite cautious once we went into lockdown to follow the scenarios that projected the worst in terms of death tolls for the UK was not just a scientific decision, but also a political one. And just as it was then, it is now. Coming out of lockdown is a combination of science and politics. But it's difficult to make that switch when you've told the public for 2 months now that everything is driven by the science. When you come up with a ranking system, a 5-4-3-2-1, that you say is driven by the science, and you know, when you just perpetuate that as the narrative, it becomes harder and harder to make what are ultimately necessary political decisions.
And Katie, yesterday on the podcast, we talked a little bit about Hong Kong and what the British government is doing in reaction to the protests and China's proposed national security law. Today, the story has moved on a little bit more. Can you update listeners on what's happened?
Yes, so this relates to the new security law China is trying to bring in to Hong Kong, which the government has made quite clear they do not approve of. And the suggestion yesterday was, were that to go ahead, The suggestion was those in Hong Kong who already have a BNO passport would be able to come here and there'd be a path to citizenship from there. Now, that figure is in the hundreds of thousands, but today from the Home Office, there's now the suggestion that actually it would be anyone who is eligible for a BNO passport, which is up to 3 million people. So it's a much higher number of people who could potentially come from Hong Kong to the UK should they want to. So I think it's now a more wide-reaching policy if it keeps going on this trajectory.
Kate, some people have said in response to this that, you know, that not that many Hong Kongers will actually take up this offer because they don't actually do want to leave their homes and move to this country. Is that the point of this policy? What's your reaction to that?
It's partially the point of the policy. If you extend the opportunity for Hong Kongers to come to the UK on extended visa that has a pathway to citizenship, you do expect that some people will take up that offer. But it is symbolic as well. I think it is a wonderful reaction to what an authoritarian regime in China has decided to do to Hong Kong by the UK saying, you know, we're not approaching this with force, we're approaching this with openness and a very liberal attitude towards the people of Hong Kong, that if you face oppression there, you can come and find freedom and your rights here in the UK. It's really an incredible offer when you think about it, and perhaps slightly suggests that the tone and change in attitude towards immigration, even just in the past few months, has moved. We saw with the NHS migrant surcharge, there was public support for removing that for healthcare workers. And I think there's real public solidarity in the UK with people in Hong Kong who just are trying to hold on to their rights and to the two systems that China originally did sign up to. So I think it's wonderfully British and actually could prove to be a life-changing policy for people experiencing oppression on the other side of the world.
And I suppose it's also symptomatic of a potential change in relationship to China, something which James writes about on the cover piece this week. And I talked to him and Sir Oliver Letwin about in the weekly podcast as well. So just to get that plug in there, Katie and Kate, thanks very much.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.